Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
On podcast number 15, it's an interview with Sean Benson from A Minor Forest and The Bus and Purple House and many other things you may know if you've been around the Bay Area for a while and going to weird events. Technical note, there's an attempt to do something with two microphones, so I sound like I'm Skyping in from somewhere else, but we're actually in the same room. And didn't really know what to do to fix that, but wanted to keep what we got with John. It's interesting stuff. So hopefully you can deal with that. Thanks to everyone who listened to the last episode, interview with Mark Georges. And I just found out that Nung Pak is actually playing in the Bay Area on September 16th at the Rickshaw Stop. And there's another show that's a secret that I can't say now, but maybe by the time this is up, it'll be announced. Maybe I'll tag it on at the end if I think about it. Also wanted to mention that Tom Carter from Charlotte Lambdy's Badger Lore, many other projects, fell into a bad state of pneumonia and asthma and is laid up in hospital in Berlin and is not going to be able to go back to work for a very long time. So there's some benefit shows going around and a website to donate to if you want to help out Tom. It's helptomcarter.org. And yeah, let's get going on the show.
Infamous Purple House with John Benson.
Yes.
Say hi, John.
Hello, George.
Yeah. I know I force people to do that, but it's good to do just to establish like a vocal thing.
Make sure the vocals are actually going through into the recording device.
Yeah. And we were just talking about how back in the 90s, Free Radio Berkeley was actually run out of this house also. Is it Radio Free Berkeley? Free Radio Berkeley?
Free Radio Berkeley is what they were calling it then, rather than Berkeley has no radio, would be the Radio Free Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
Yeah, so rather than being free of radio, they decided to make the t-shirts say at least
Free Radio.
Since it wasn't really a actual legitimate thing, they could really do whatever they wanted to.
Right, and that was one of the first cases, right, of, well, probably not the first case of pirate radio, but that was like a pretty significant one.
Yeah. What it was is the Stephen Dunifer, kind of the head of the movement, kind of got syndicated in a funny way where he was challenging it. And he went on all of these big talk shows, and he wasn't the greatest public speaker, unfortunately. He was a good mumbler, but he pushed it. He actually pushed it by suing the Supreme Court. at the Supreme Court level suing the FCC to see if they could do community-based micro-broadcasting legally and open it up a little bit. It was right before the internet. It just basically just foreshadowed mid-90s? Podcasting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I moved into this house in 92, and it was probably just a few years after that that the radio station started transmitting out of here.
Did they finally, did he live in the house, or he would just come in and do stuff?
No, I actually didn't meet him for a long time.
Okay.
There was a huge community, and the radio station is partially responsible for us being able to keep the house as it is.
Really?
It was a really dramatic, very exciting time period. Because
maybe I should back up and explain. Purple House has been here since the late 80s?
Well, it used to be a pink house, and it was, I moved in 92, like I said. I came to a party here that the band Flipper was playing at, and I was a big Flipper fan, and I pretty much just stayed and am here still today,
that actually
20 years later.
Yeah, that reminds me. That's kind of, I think, the context of when I met Rob Enbaum. Somehow Flipper was brought up. He's like, oh, I'm in a Flipper cover band with John Benson from AMI Chorus. I was like, really? You? Okay. And then actually, I think, was he in Tick War at some point with Rob and Tick War?
We jammed with Andy a few times, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We never performed.
Yeah, I remember just hearing about it.
Yeah. I was suffering with a broken neck when I met Rob, and I had been in bed for months in traction. And I had never met him before, and he kind of came over and sat on the couch and had a, like, I'm learning how to play guitar. I check it out, and he, like, get really excited and start playing the D chord and the E chord and the D chord, and I'm just starved for any input at all.
Yeah.
So,
well, so actually, it's interesting that he didn't play it, because he was just a singer in a band, because he was in a.
Well, he was in a white boy rap band from Walnut Creek,
right.
Magnum.
Legendary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Mark as well. So.
Mark was in Magnum?
Yeah. Oh,
I did not know that. Also.
Yeah. Yeah.
We and should then play some Magnum if we have.
I know, at this point, definitely to give it some,
to play that.
Some context would be relevant. And honestly, it could not have been the furthest from the A minor forest aesthetic, other than the fact that it was completely. I felt that it pushed the DIY aesthetic a little further, because Magnum was this trying to figure out rap music, but they were playing in donut shops and parks, and A minor forest had just stopped playing, like, the war, like, what was that place that we played? Great American Music Hall.
I was at that show,
that
actually.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, you were?
The last show you guys did?
Yeah.
We
played there a couple
was
times.
Was 3 Mile Pilot on
3 Mile
that?
Pilot played
so
there.
So that was, like, 97, 98?
Yes.
Right around there?
One of those two
so
years.
One of those
that
years.
When it stopped.
Yeah, so backing up, so John, you may know his old band, A minor forest.
Yes.
And the other band we're talking about with Rob Enbaum called Hail Zookas. And Evil Wicked Warrior.
Oh, yes.
You and Mark Small and your daughter, Quinn.
Mm-hmm.
And Life. And that has not happened for a while. That's kind of stopped a while ago, right?
No. My daughter started writing songs, as all children do, when she was little. And I loved rocking out with her, because there's nothing like rocking out with a little kid. Book shows for that band. We played a lot of parties. and recorded two CDs, I guess. Yeah.
And never really toured, but just played around here, right?
We did the West Coast.
Oh, you did the West Coast.
Yeah.
Tour. Okay.
Yeah, we went to Disneyland. We didn't play Disneyland, but we went to Disneyland.
Just a band vacation.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what... And your current thing, you just were telling me... You put together a collection of songs that are maybe older four-track recordings. And Dan Beckman is going to put it out on his label?
Yeah, he has a label. He lives in Maine. I think it's called Turned World.
Yeah, I think that's
right.
Yeah.
Changes sometimes.
Well, that Burn Porter record, they did that record, right?
They sure did. That
was
great.
I heard that
fantastic.
At your house before. Yeah, I heard that record.
Yeah, that was really awesome. I think he put out a Bastard Noise or... some kind of Man is a Bastard related
thing.
Amps for Christ thing.
I think that there is an Amps for Christ split with Space Duke of Space Corners or whatever.
Yes.
All his projects are the kind of variations on the same name.
Including the record label, it seems.
Right.
He was in Practical Cockpit.
Right.
And that was New Orleans.
That's right. So then backing up off of that. So yeah, like we were saying, the house... has been here for like 20 years or more, and what you're saying about community I think is interesting. Like there is a total community vibe here, and I feel like it's kind of a stopping point for a lot of people. Like
mm-hmm.
people will just mm-hmm. be able to crash here traveling through town.
Yeah.
It's just a welcoming kind of situation, and at the same time, like, I would feel like a little bit like I don't have enough privacy.
Yeah.
Like, that's an issue for me.
Yeah.
I had a lot of people at my house all the time. It was like, oh, this is cool, this is happening, but I can't, like, you know, wander into my bathroom in, like, my underwear or whatever without worrying about someone seeing it. Or,
mm-hmm.
You
know. I do. That's
yeah.
All right.
I mean, I guess I'm just uptight about that kind of thing. But
we have a guest room in the attic where a lot of the touring bands, and my whole thing was coming from the DIY band experience. And when A Minor Forest was touring, we're talking 93, and there's no, it was the time period that you know is when we were looking for payphones, who has quarters, where's that piece of paper that's folded up on the floor of the van with the phone number of somebody who might be able to lead us to the host house, who will then drive us to whatever the venue may be, which is probably a bar, and yeah. Asking directions at a 7-Eleven that we're so grateful to find. Pretty much my bent on the whole community thing with the music was because we had done so much touring and we had slept on so many floors of so many people's houses that it was just... that was the lifestyle, and that was going to be my mission in life, and that continued. So a lot of this house, besides putting on the shows, is also a place for the people to stay, or if they didn't get a show, they can hang out. So there's a lot of influence in the whole DIY aesthetic into what this house has become.
Right.
And it's not... well...
Because it's sort of like a cross of, like, there's a DIY thing, which you're talking about, and then there's sort of, like, a general Berkeley kind of hippie thing.
Yeah.
So there's kind of both those things, and they coexist in a good way here,
yeah.
It seems like. They manage to coexist.
It's been a struggle in the past because maybe you remember this also, is that there was much more divisive politics back. I feel that there's been a big change within the last few years where there was... the whole Riot Girl thing, the 90s thing, the straight edge thing. And me personally growing up, when I moved to California, I'd never heard of a vegetarian. And I, you know, only lived with white people in the farmlands of Ohio. And I come here and my mother is a lesbian with a purple mohawk and a motorcycle and living in a tent and has two babies, little kids. And my whole world went from living with my dad, who is really into bikes, beers, and boobs, like Harley culture, to living with this separatist lesbian community, which didn't allow men, and it was very, I don't want to use the word divisive, but it was trying to form a whole new identity, and it was like second wave feminism that was, it did exclude trying to create women-only spaces. And I didn't understand that when I was 13, coming into puberty, trying to understand anything.
That's really interesting, because we were kind of on this tangent before about the alpha male thing and how we, like, we're not alpha males. Our other friend we're talking about, we don't need to name him, not an alpha male in terms of, like, when, you know, initiating anything with dating and things like that. And I kind of had a similar thing, too, where I felt like, because I went to a Catholic all-boys school, and I just didn't really have a lot of contact with girls in that time period, where it's very important and informative to do that. But also, I, you know, found out about Riot Girl around the same time, and I had this really weird removal of, like, yeah, I'm kind of like a feminist, but I'm a feminist in a place where there are no women. And, like, I don't know how to represent for that, or, like, you know, understand in, you know, the context of, like, a Catholic school.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you, I was like, I know about Bikini Kill, but I don't know how to, who I can talk to about that here. There's, like, no way to really, there were some people that I came up with that were, like, punks, and, like, they were mostly skater kids, and they, there was a little bit of a punk scene in San Jose that I kind of dabbled into, or kind of, I didn't feel like I was really one yet, but,
What about the straight edge part of that? Did that come with the Riot Girl part, or were you a straight edge Riot Girl at that point?
You know, I don't know if there was a lot of straight edge Riot Girls. Is that like a, was that a big thing at the time? I think that, for me, it was more like, I just never really got an interest in it, and, it just kind of never appealed to me. Yeah, for you, because you're also sober, and you've pretty much been sober your whole life.
Well, that was directly from living with an alcoholic father, so I was intensely shy, and we were moving around constantly, and he was always getting DUIs and fired, so we would end up in another town, and I came straight from that to California, where it seemed like anything is possible, and I got used to my dad saying, hey, John, here, have a beer, have a shot of this. And I was always like, oh, Dad, no, Dad. And that continued through the rest of my life to this day. I still have never been drunk.
That's interesting, because I think when I talked to Nate, a little bit behind his being sober, I think was similar. The Nate Denver, I don't think that ended up on the thing. Was just like, you know, being really around an alcoholic person when you're a kid, and then seeing sort of the behavior that can actually turn someone fully a 180 against it.
Yeah.
And some people just end up becoming alcoholics also.
Mm-hmm.
But I, that's not really, I don't really have that much of a history of that in my family, but I can totally understand that being, you know, enough of a motivator for some people. Mm. So, but it wasn't like your relationship with your dad was strained then, or was it actually okay?
No, it was okay. It's just that he was one of those kind of distant, closed down,
Midwestern dudes.
Midwestern, it's very typical. But I didn't know what was. He lied a lot. He was constantly lying. He would come home with a Model A Ford, and it was beautiful. And he's like, "This is your first car," and then he'd sell it like 2 days later. Or like, I was supposed to do this cross country trip, and I bought a Harley Davidson. I took it out there, and we were gonna fix our Harleys up together and do this cross country trip. And he sold it, but he told me that he was looking forward to the trip. So I spent 2 years saving up money. And just like the whole Harley culture wasn't necessarily...
Like, you go to like Sturgis and stuff?
I went to Sturgis all the time.
Oh,
like, I saw a ZZ Top there. And like, I have this huge affinity for like the whole male bearded guns womanizer thing. But at the same time, a direct rejection of that too, and it's because my dad was my audience, like all the way up until he died. Like, a lot of what I did, including being in a rock band, was to show. Like, I thought that's what my dad wanted for himself. You know, he played guitar, and he was really into the ladies and all of that. But I did it completely wrong. You know, I took the music very seriously, and I wrote complicated parts with cello and quiet parts, and like this, I was like, I'm gonna be really smart about this. My dad's gonna totally love it, and I'm gonna play for him. And we played at a all ages venue in Ohio. He showed up totally drunk, and they wouldn't let him in. I had to explain that it was my dad. He thought this place was elitist, and he just walked across the street to the bar while
it's
we played.
It's like Speak in Tongues or something in Cleveland?
Speak in Tongues, yes.
Yeah,
that was it. That was it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now that I'm even trying to piece together, how did your parents even get together? That
My mom
like
was very
cool.
young.
Yeah,
she was very young and sheltered from I'm flying out there tomorrow morning to go to this house that my grandfather built. And, yeah, that was actually something I did want to talk about, was the fact that I'm going out to see my grandmother. She's probably not going to be around much more than another month.
Your mom's
or so.
Mom.
And this is my mom's mom, and she's 95, and she lives in the house that my grandfather built. And every time I go out there, I admire something new about this house. He overbuilt this house. But to look at it, it's just this one-story, modest brick house. But the studs are like 6 inches apart, and the plaster work is immaculate, and the electrical work is just overdone with really thick wires. And as I grow up, I appreciate these things.
Right. You now, do wiring in the house.
Owning this house and fixing up this 100-year-old house constantly, I am over again and again and again reaffirming that my grandfather was a genuinely good guy. He, by the time he was 40, he had overbuilt this house. He had set up a retirement fund for my grandmother. He paid for his own funeral. He had everything. By the time he was my age now, he had everything set for my grandmother so that when he did pass away, which he did in his 40s, she was set for the rest of her life in this very modest existence. And I mean, she also did have a job, and she has a retirement from that, but it was just at the library down the street. So that was the environment my mom grew up in, was just like this really Midwestern. My grandfather was kind of the figurehead of that area. So as I get older, I realize how much my grandfather was involved in building this community. He built a large part of what Maumee, Ohio is. And so going back there is constantly reaffirming this part of me that I never really met because he was gone by the time I was of personhood. So anyway, I'm going to go back there tomorrow with my daughter. We're going to fly out there. We're going to see my grandma. And it's going to be, it's I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be kind of heavy. And
is your mom going to be out there?
She's already there. Yeah, she's so, already there.
Yeah, that's a hard age to get past. I mean, that's a pretty impressive age to get to.
Mm-hmm.
95.
Yeah.
But that's interesting because that's like a kind of a patriarchal model that is very different, it sounds like, than your dad.
Oh, yes.
Which is, you had sort of this idealized, Midwestern Norman Rockwell kind of grandfather.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hell-raising dad.
Yeah, my dad, the first time he met my mom's dad, my mom's dad was practicing rope tricks out in the backyard. He was spinning a lasso. So my dad comes walking up the driveway, and my grandfather lassos my dad and pulls him up. So my grandfather used to, like, ride on the backs of horses and jump through lassos and stuff like that when he was a youth.
That kind of reminds me of, like, I'm not done with this book. I've got this Alan Lomax biography.
Oh, cool.
And do you know about, like, his father was actually a collector of cowboy songs and kind of had some legitimacy of being like, you know, a Texas boy or whatever when he went to Harvard and like
took
folklore classes. And so, yeah, there was like the whole precedent for Alan Lomax wanting to impress his dad.
Oh, yeah.
Being like, you
very
know, like, I want to like live up to the Lomax name, you know, as being a collector of folk musics.
Right.
So it's real interesting how we do all these things to like kind of appease. Yeah, that thing you're saying, like, having your dad as your audience.
Excuse me.
No, that's fine. We'll just do it. We'll cut around that.
Okay.
Cut around it. Cut it out. I can kind of relate to that, even though I didn't really feel like I shared my music stuff with my dad that much. Actually, like, right before, you know, like, he passed away a couple years ago, now a year and a half now, I'd sent him an email, like, because I did that Reese Chatham 200 guitar thing. I'm like, this kind of seems like something an Asian parent might like because it's at Lincoln Center. So I did kind of like send that out there and just kind of like feel test the waters a little bit. Like, you know, it's weird to not feel like you can share some of that stuff. And like, I just weirdly, my mom, I just kind of called her randomly. The weird thing is, like, I heard this interview with Yoko Ono and I was like, I should call my mom. I really had that thought. I don't know what it is, like Asian mom thing, but I call my mom and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm at Stanford, I'm about to do this radio show at Stanford. And she actually like bothered to listen, which I thought was very weird and not really a typical behavior that either of us would do. I would never normally tell her I'm doing something and she would never normally listen. But I think she's kind of realizing, like, oh, you know, this is not a phase. Like, this is what he does. I maybe should pay a little bit of attention to it. So it's kind of nice to bridge that a little bit with your parents. So your mom's pretty supportive of everything you've been doing.
Oh, intensely, yeah.
And she's so when you came out here, you were 13, and it was in the Bay Area. This like lesbian commune.
Well, she was dating. Well, yeah, I was young enough to be totally confused by everything, so I'm not exactly sure what was happening. I do have it was difficult because she was living in some kind of church housing. She spent a couple of years living on Mount Tam in a tent with my brother and sister, and they had a pet deer named Sugar Plum. And by the time I came out here, they were in a church housing in San Leandro, and so when I was in high school, basically, I was absolutely terrified of women. I was terrified of talking to most people. You know, I ended up with one friend that I stuck with loyally, and spent a lot of time trying to find a hole somewhere to crawl into most of the time. But I was also really inspired. My mom was lovely and wonderful, and I was very inspired by all that she was doing, arts, and she had an exciting lifestyle and all of that. But
what was the church that they were part of?
It was a Unitarian church.
Oh, so that sounds progressive. Yeah, like Christian church.
Yeah.
Is that still part of her deal? She's still
not really, no. That was kind of more about her willing to manage this house with a bunch of other families. And so ever since I came to California, I've been living in group housing. That's always been my, I almost wouldn't know otherwise.
You lived at Barrington.
Oh, yes. That was a huge part of my life.
That's probably something that doesn't get talked about too much.
No.
We should probably address some of that.
The weird thing is that nobody knows what that is.
Yeah, the weird thing is I lived in that place years after it had been converted into just private housing.
I forgot about that. Was it Huddlestone Hall?
Oh, I forgot the name of it, too, and I just, like, there was no kitchen. Well, there's, like, a communal kitchen. It was just, like, rooms. Like, it was, like, a boarding house in a weird way.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so long ago I wasn't paying much rent. But, yeah, I remember other people coming over and being like, I saw Primus play in your basement, and I took acid.
Uh-huh.
Like, in your yard. And, like, yeah, so we were there for, what, a year?
No, I was there all the way. I was there for 2 years in the summer, and I was of the group of people who were suing to keep the place from getting shut down.
Oh, okay.
And actually, the lawsuit got reduced alphabetically, so it was John Benson versus the people of California.
You have that, like, on your record. So Barrington was a part of the co-op student housing system of UC Berkeley on the south side of campus. And they were the first ones, I think, to get, like, thrown out. And I heard, like, people were paying their rent in drugs at the time.
There was the building was the first student co-op. The military built the building in the first place.
Okay.
And it was the largest in the world student co-op. And there was almost 200 people, 200 students living there who would, you know, cook dinner together and study together. And there was a huge downstairs open kind of cafeteria style, but everything was just trash. It was like benches that were broken. And
did that kitchen start in the 60s? Was it part of that era?
It was in the 40s.
It's been around. It started in the 40ths. So the co-op system dates that far back.
I'm not too clear on that. The military housing might be older. Yeah, I'm not too clear on that. I know that the building itself was built long before then. It became a co-op, which my grandfather, who I was just speaking very highly of, was a big part of. In World War II, there was a huge movement towards cooperativism, and the government was pushing it. The whole Victory Farm stamps, you know, give your pennies to the bullet-making factories and Rosie the Riveter and all of that kind of stuff was a part of a cooperative farm, having your own community protect itself through shared resources.
Oh, that's really interesting. And my grandfather,
it was a really big movement in World War II, and out of that came the student cooperatives, which was students bonding together, buying a house, living collectively, buying their food, doing the chores, keeping it running, to live affordably and be able to. Berkeley had many co-ops. There's the banks and the groceries, and there's a lot of anything you can imagine had its version of a cooperative system. So that influenced me a lot when I first got out here. And I didn't really know much about it, and I didn't know that my grandfather was so involved in it until very late after I started to understand what it was. I found all of these old pamphlets from the 40s all over my grandmother. I just came home with a couple that are sitting over on my bookshelf just last month.
So it's like, yeah, like you could start a co-op to keep America going, to keep America strong.
Yeah.
Like it was like, it yeah. should not be the message that I think anyone in Berkeley would be too endorsing of now. It's
right, that's ironic, yeah.
It is pretty funny how that works.
It's very ironic. There was a full-blown riot that happened when they were closing it down, where dumpsters were set on fire and police with shields came out. And it was supposed to, do you remember the band The Beatniks?
Oh, well, that's Michael Frontes.
Michael Frontes, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Okay, of course. So they were playing at our poetry reading, and it was... The Beatniks were all about kind of this industrial bang hubcaps together and use a grinder and rap about how television is evil. And it really riled up. Like, we took almost everything in what was the kitchen and just started smashing it and banging on the doors and breaking holes in the windows. And it turned into this, like, huge scale. A lot of people came to it, a lot of big...
It's hilarious when you think of, like, Michael Frontes, all peace and love all the time. Right. Now. Like, he was in this weird proto-industrial band, which is, you know, those things can coexist. It's fine. I mean, just as, like, we're talking about the irony of, like, you were in this situation that's kind of notoriously known for, like, its drug scene. And Berkeley, I think, always has had a reputation for that. But we're talking about how you and I being sober people, how that can be a weird... It can be a weird social impediment in some ways to be sober around people that are partying because they feel guilty around you.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, like, I feel like I'm trying not to be judgmental as much as I can be.
Yeah.
A lot of the time.
Well, my 15-year-old self just is dying for being accepted and wanting to be involved in any way I can. And inherently feeling... and. You can totally understand this,
yeah.
But inherently feeling...
I'm a comic. Yeah, I'm like, I think I want acceptance, yeah.
But for some reason, just feeling like you're going to always be an outsider, you know, like for whatever reason it is, I think that you and I are friends, and I'm friends with the people in this house, and I've been friends with... Because for whatever reason in their life or their genetic makeup as it is, they are just going to be an outsider to some degree. And... that wasn't cool before Pearl Jam. You know what I'm saying? It's like there wasn't...
Pearl Jam made something cool. I don't know.
I remember going to the very first meetings when Gilman was starting to become a thing, and it was the idea of having an all-ages show space was really the bottom line, and that's where I agreed with it. But at the time, they had Thursday... family theater, a movie night where they got a projector on Fridays. It wasn't a punk club. It was a, dare I say it, community space. But it was specifically with the agenda of all ages, non-drinking, so that you can bring a 13-year-old there and feel like this is a really creative... And I was like, hook, line, and sinker. This is what I wanted to be part of because it was all about what I loved. What Barrington did for me was provided a space... I'm not going to call it a safe space, but it was a space where people...
Sounds like it was.
Yeah. An inclusion space.
Inclusion.
I felt very included with all of these freaks just kind of pushing each other to be more of a freak and do more and more extreme things, pushing and pushing and pushing. And I felt really, really nurtured in that environment. And I, you know, have lots of theories as to why, because where I came from was not... safe. You know, like the whole Harley culture, like people doing speed and fixing their carburetors on the kitchen table and then driving their, you know, just there was no stability living with my dad at all. So in this, the stability was the fact that we were all an audience to what we came up with in an extreme environment. And that it wasn't necessarily just music and art, it was your philosophy and your outlook on the world. And people would just ran with it at a very young age.
You never lived in San Diego, but
I never did live in San Diego.
But you just were in a band with people from San Diego, so you just ended up having a lot of connections.
Yeah, the other two guys in Amount of Forest were from San Diego, so we would go down there and play maybe more than we'd play locally here.
Yeah.
So I guess
not
really well
in the 90s. Do you have any sort of stories about the formation of that group?
The band?
Yeah. It's like, when did that actually all come
That's together? Embarrassing. I don't know. It involves a hot tub and an ex-girlfriend and the mother of my daughter and, yeah, all sorts of stuff. The first A Minor Forest show, we had mimes. We played, the whole idea was to do two notes. We played the same two notes over and over and over again. Okay. And the song was called God is Fabulous. And we had people dressed up on stage with us who were, you know, that was the very first time we all played together. And it was going in with like, most people are going to see this as the most horrendous thing that they have ever experienced. And being... thinking that is so great. And the first, Jay, who does Lesser,
yeah.
The first time I ever saw somebody on his knees on the floor with a bunch of pedals all plugged into each other making this horrific noise, he was the guy doing it.
Yeah.
And he went into it with the exact same, I hate, his first release was
yeah.
I Hate Me.
Yeah.
And that was so beautiful to me. I felt that was so liberating and so wonderful to be able to do it with such confidence that this is going to be horrible. Yeah.
Yeah. it's kind of nihilistic, I guess, in a way, but it was like, I wouldn't say like Lesser is like G.G. Allen or anything at all.
No, yeah.
It's just like kind of a humorous way to be like, you know, have self-loathing, I guess.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Which we can segue into the bus at this point because there's a lot of
Feeling like you are enabling other things to happen, maybe at expense to your own financial well-being or psychic well-being. But what was the first thing that got the bus going? Was it just seeing that there was one for sale?
I had done a tour with Hale Zukas in an ambulance, and the ambulance, we were tinkering with vegetable oil, and I had been trying to run diesels on vegetable oil since a minor forest, and it was kind of like I was looking for a diesel, and my dad had just died, and I had just seen the bus after I got back from this Hale Zukas tour. Hale Zukas fell apart. We just played with Friends Forever on the whole country. They broke up. It's like, it felt like everything had just, and my dad just died, and my girlfriend of 6 years just broke up with me, and I had found out that she was cheating on me the entire time we were going out. And I just felt like, okay, this is the bottom of the barrel.
You bottomed.
I totally bottomed.
Silver bottom.
everything is over. I wasn't staying in my bedroom. I was sleeping in my van in the ambulance. So anyway, I was in a horrible, horrible state. And the fact that my dad just died felt like I lost the entire childhood, what little childhood I had, because he was the only person who actually witnessed my childhood, because it was just him and I. So I didn't have the possibility of doing these Harley trips or the possibility of him being the person that I thought of him as and was defending him as being this certain person. He was gone. And not only that, but I found out that he had used my driver's license and got DUIs on my driver's license. He had used my social security number and damaged my credit rating. He had done the same to my brother. He had gotten credit cards out in my grandmother's name, and she had been dead for a long time. But anyways, he was living in the house that he grew up in. He moved back in with his mom when she was dying. And he married somebody who was only 5 years older than me, who was basically – all of these horrible things were coming up. And the house he had gotten a third mortgage on, and it got repossessed. So I learned that not only was he probably was killed in a bar – suddenly overnight, and I had to go out to Ohio and get his things. So all I knew was that I had to go save what little was left of what
your
was
childhood.
My dad, my childhood. And that would meant his guitars that he taught me to play guitar on, possibly some photos, maybe some old furniture of my grandparents, my wonderful grandfather's electronic testing equipment, you know, all of this nostalgia that I had to go save it because it was being thrown away. So I saw that a 40-foot bus that the Oakland Police Department had gutted and covered with sheet metal, and it was just this ugly behemoth that was going to be converted to vegetable oil and driven to Ohio cheap, and we were going to save all of my dad's stuff. And I say we, but it was actually just me. This was what I was going to do, and it was just like, what was that Herzog film, Fitzcarraldo, who was pushing the ship over the mountain? I was in that frame of mind. And a lot of friends who saw the bus were like, this is like a giant warehouse. Let's have a party in here. Let's have a send-off show. Let's, hey, John, your birthday's coming up. Evil Wicked Warrior plays in front of Mama Buzz inside of this giant bus. It's going to be awesome. And it was. It was really, really fun. And a bunch of people were like, hey, I want to go on this trip. It kind of organically formed its own, this Noah's Ark or whatever. So I installed solar panels, and I took all these wheelchair batteries and put them under the floor and set up a PA system. And we had this little PA. It was running on vegetable oil. It's just all of this stuff kind of started coming together, and people little by little started joining in on this ark. Drove it around the country, did get my dad's stuff. We would pull into these little towns. The people that were with me, we were getting closer and closer and closer. The core group of people, when one person would speak, everybody was sitting in a circle, and we were just like this really tight family at this point that we were on this trip.
Yeah, I actually like wanted to touch on that too. Yeah, it really was like a thing that people knew about even up and down the West Coast. And like kind of there's people that are kind of affiliated with that. When I think of like, oh yeah, those are like bus kids. There's like a bit of a scene around that. Like I guess like people like Dalton and like the East Bay people and like Oshin.
Yeah,
and,
for
like,
sure.
John Lando, obviously, and Dave.
Yeah.
Like, the only people that know how to drive it are you and Dave and John moved
right.
to New York, so...
It's a 14-foot tall, 40-foot long warehouse on wheels, yeah. and it's got no windows except for the windshield. So I couldn't. It was a death trap, honestly. And we would pull into a very, very small town where nothing was going on, and have a show. And people were like, "What the hell is this?" And they were either like, "Get the hell out of my town," or they're like, "Thank you, Vision of Good. Let me join your clan."
Yeah.
And that both happened every single night as we drove around the country for a few months. And it just kept going and going and going. And I didn't really want to go home. Like it just was this wonderful experience to continue.
So the first trip was actually on the way to go get your dad's stuff.
Yeah.
Was it around INC?
No, that was the second trip. Yeah, the first time we went and I needed to get my stuff. I know.
Amazing it made it that many times. How many times across country did this?
A couple of times, but we left it in Miami. We went to INC. That was just amazing.
Which is the International Noise Conference.
International Noise Conference.
Put together by Rad Bastard and some other people.
Yeah.
Mostly Rad.
Yeah.
It's mostly Rad's thing.
And a lot of people came with us to that and... just every day was Jail would say crises. Why are there so many crises? Because things were catching on fire constantly. People were falling out of it. You know, just people just like peeing off the roof, or you know, there she is naked on the roof again. Why are all these cars swerving into me? It's like, oh yeah, she's naked on the roof again.
She being, I'm guessing, I don't know, Jessie.
No. Oh yeah, she was. Naked yeah.
A lot.
Yeah, she did.
Dylan.
Dylan was naked a lot.
Just because they were
Rob
naked.
Was
they were naked on the record covers. But
well, basically, I took it all on the road, so it was a little mini Barrington purple house on the road. And
little Ken Kesey, Mary Prankster.
A little bit, yeah.
Which is, I don't know if that how much of an influence that is for you. Any of that '60s kind of stuff.
The bus whole thing came together really like on its own. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily. Something that I was going to continue at all. And I didn't think that I wasn't thinking like, hey, we're going to be the Merry Pranksters at all. That didn't cross my mind until somebody in Pennsylvania was like, oh yeah, we pulled on some old lady's front lawn. I was trying to turn around cause I couldn't get through a tunnel cause we were too tall. And I ended up doing like a 5-6 point turn and I was on somebody's lawn and she was like, what are you? And this old hippie came out of his house and walking over there and he like put his arm around her and he's like, it's a magic bus.
That is awesome.
Yeah, yeah, it was pretty amazing experience all the way through. I really am grateful that it happened. It's still kind of happening, but it just drained every penny that I had and still is.
And the kind of the capper to that first bus is what it broke down near Michigan.
We had done a series of shows up the East Coast into Detroit. We had done 5 shows in Detroit on the same day. There was this giant flash thunderstorm. People off the streets were jumping into the bus with the doors wide open. We played in the abandoned train station. The police were constantly following us. The people were doing drugs, and there's all sorts. It was a day that. Being the only sober driver, the continual a designated driver that I am, I was driving this group of people from 60 to 13 all over Detroit who were on for the show. And I hadn't slept. I was a little bit stressed out. I'm like, please arrest me. Somebody please arrest me. Like, I really need a break. Will somebody please just throw me in jail? This is completely wrong.
Like daring the universe to stop you.
Exactly. And we were driving from Detroit. The sun had come up. We were driving through a town. We were going to Chicago, and the bus just kind of slowly petered to a stop, and I coasted off the freeway in a little town called Albion and pulled over, and this half-naked girl came up who I never saw before in my life and was like, are we going back? And she gave a cross street in Detroit somewhere. And I'm like, well, we're a few hours away from Detroit right now. We're going to Chicago. She's like, you're from California, right? And I was like, yeah, are you going to California? Yeah, we're going to go to California eventually. Oh, good. I've always wanted to go to California. All right. I having no idea who was on the bus with me at this point. I think that honestly, the bus just knew that I psychically was completely about to just crack. So the bus stopped working.
It's like your TARDIS.
Yeah.
you're in tune with it.
Yes.
And then so it sounds like the story that happened after that is like it was actually cheaper to just get a property to park it on than to have it in a garage.
Yeah.
And someone would just charge you so much more money to keep
half
it
of
there.
Albion's a really cute town with three rivers, brick roads. Half of it is a ghost town. So I bought a house for $4,000 and left the bus in Albion, and that was a few years ago. And now I'm here. And the goal may still be, maybe not, I don't know, to go back and fix the whatever blue. I have no idea.
When you had like people just go kind of house sit for the Albion house, right? Basically.
Yeah. Krumar recorded his album there. Rachel, who lives in that room over there now, apparently had been living there with her twin sister and Jason. I had no idea. And so I wanted it kind of to be the dream was that all of these touring bands that are going across the country and I sympathize can stay in this house. The key will be hidden. Just go there, do what you need to do. It's a really cute town, swim in the river, record an album. And it kind of did, you know, people came up from Chicago to stay in the house and needed to get away. Electricity and water was all turned on and everything. But it kind of took a turn sour where I created this fake utopia, but it really was attached to my bank account. And people did things in the house that damaged the property, and I was getting fined for it. And the neighbors were like, what the hell is going on with this house? And so I had to answer to the city, and I was the person that had to answer to everything. So, you know, whenever something would break on the bus, I had to fix it. Whenever something in this house, I am the, for a long time, my name was on the insurance. I had to be the landlord, you know. And that was not who I wanted to be. And still, that's not my goal in life.
But you are, by default, sometimes the most responsible person around.
Yeah, at least the most sober one, yeah.
That's what seems crazy about it. But I like that phrase, a fake utopia that is draining my bank account. I totally can relate to that.
Yes.
All. I think that we all often have
George, is it
like
Zum
that.
Or Zoom?
I like to say it's Zum, like umbrella.
On the radio today, they said Zoom.
I didn't correct him. I don't. Okay. I never correct people.
Okay.
I kind of don't care. I kind of want it to be amorphous. Well, I kind of feel like what you're saying about fake utopia, I definitely relate to. And that's a hard thing to deal with because, I mean, you're still putting your energy into all these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and what is the trade-off when you, you know, are like, you know, you could have put a mortgage on the house or whatever. Like, you know, you could have like gotten equity out of being a house, but you're like, I'm going to sell it back for a dollar to the co-op.
Yeah.
And not feel like, I don't know, where there's a certain line of like where selflessness and like being helpful to people can be damaging mm-hmm. to yourself. And mm-hmm. I don't know if you seem like you've hit that with the bus a couple times.
Oh, yeah, I've hit that with many things.
Yeah.
I mean, my job included, you know, like I fix wheelchairs for a living, but I also created the job. I created the whole emergency repair program that the city of Berkeley pays for. And it's such little money. Like, I make very, very little money doing that. But it's exactly what I want to do, and I would do it for free. You know, if somebody's wheelchair is broken on the street, you know, like, who wouldn't want to go over and fix their wheelchair? So I taught myself how to fix all these wheelchairs, and I have lots of resources, and I actually get paid to do it. So it's part of that original ethic of creating the life that you want to, not just the life that you want to live, but the life that you want to use as an example for other people that this world is possible.